glad to have you all with us for today's Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nygut. We've got a great show lined up for you today. We're going to be talking about the life of Ronald Reagan, a new biography by Bob Spitz. He's with us live in the studio. Before we get to that, I'd like to make just a couple of brief announcements. First of all, you know, our pledge drive, our fall pledge drive, ended on Friday afternoon, and I want to thank you for two things. Number one, so many of you supported GPB Radio and told our folks you were doing it because Political Rewind has come to mean a lot to you in terms of the way we talk about the political news of the day. So first, thank you for that. But second, I know, believe me, how frustrating pledge shows are. I mean, we talk for a few minutes, then we go to a long pledge break. We have to do that because it's how we sustain our work. But the fact that you stay with us and still want to hear what we have to say is something that means a lot to me, and I appreciate the fact that you did just that. Okay. We are going to be, as you know, in Savannah on October 30th, doing our show in front of a live audience. We still have some seats left, I'm told. It's free, of course, but we want you to register because we want to know that we have enough seats for everybody. Just go to gpb.org, gpbnews.org/community, and you'll see how to do that. Our Atlanta event, which is a week from tonight, is sold out completely.
Wow.
They all know you're going to be there, Galloway.
Of course. Well, even so, they come.
And a couple other quick notes. On Friday, we're going to have Stacey Abrams live in the studio to talk about her game. But that's going to be fun, Jim.
Get your questions ready. Send them in. Send them in.
And one way you can do that, of course, as you all know, is by watching the show on Facebook Live. Just go to the GPB news page on Facebook and join us. And if you've got tweets you want us to have, go to Politics GPB. All right. Tom Faust, have I gotten all the announcements out of the way now? He's looking at his sheet. And now... Oh, election night. We're going to be on all night, election night. We're going to start with, I think, TV at 7 in the evening, do an hour on TV. Then we're going to be on the radio on the statewide network for the rest of the night, bringing you the news as in one of the most consequential elections in decades in Georgia and across the country. All right. That said, we've already said hello briefly to Jim Galloway, the lead political writer for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. You read his column in the Dead Tree edition of the paper on Wednesdays and Sundays. And, of course, he oversees the Political Insider blog on myajc.com, where you can get news about politics throughout the day and night. Hi.
Good to be here.
Yeah, it's good to have you with us. You have a terrific column on the Insider blog right now about the luncheon that you were at with Sam Nunn.
It was, and I'll be writing more about this for Wednesday, but it was an all-day affair celebrating Sam Nunn's 80th birthday, and in the audience, front and center, was Ted Turner.
Wow. And we know Ted is, the family has just announced that he indeed is suffering from dementia.
Yeah, people don't know about the Ted Turner and Sam Nunn had one of the most important political partnerships to come out of the Peachtree Road area, just with the Nuclear Threat Initiative.
One of the great nuggets in that piece is Sam Nunn telling you that one thing he may have some regrets about, he's still kind of thinking through in his mind, is voting in favor of Clarence Thomas's confirmation to the Supreme Court. An interesting and timely revelation.
In 91, yeah. Yeah, he and Weish Fowler both voted for him and have questions.
All right. With that said, I want to welcome Bob Spitz to the show. Bob Spitz is a multi-award-winning author, best-selling writer of biographies. Probably your best-known work, Bob, is The Beatles. You did... the biography of them, it's The Beatles, the biography. And that was an acclaimed book, but you also wrote Dearie, The Remarkable Life of Julia Child, And now you come along. Oh, and by the way, Jim, Bob told us as we were sitting here, his other claim to fame is that he once was Bruce Springsteen's manager.
Oh, just off the cuff. Yeah,
Bob. Hi, Bob.
Thanks very much. Nice to be here. Thank you, Bill.
So you have written, I've got to tell you, both Jim and I agreed that this biography of Reagan is just kind of delicious reading. So congratulations.
I'm so happy to hear that. Yeah.
And it's a hefty volume. But after writing all these entertainment biographies, why suddenly Ronald Reagan?
Yeah, it's a question every one of my friends has been asking me. You know, after I wrote The Beatles and Julia Child's Diary, I was thinking of another subject. And my wife said to me, there are two characteristics of the books that you write. One is that you write about people who are beloved. And the second is that they have changed the culture. And when we were looking for another subject for me, finding someone who fit those two categories was incredibly difficult. I spent about 6 months going through all of the Kennedy Center honorees, the presidential medals. Beloved and changing the culture, boy, that is just difficult. And finally, she said to me, what about Ronald Reagan? And I initially went, what, are you crazy? She knows, and all my friends know, that I'm a longtime Democrat. In fact, I don't think I've ever voted for a Republican. I'm just not wired that way. And yet, the more I thought about it, the more I thought that here is a man I didn't understand. I didn't vote for him twice, of course, but I didn't understand his popularity, but I recognized the fact that, yes, indeed, he is beloved by so many people in this country, and wow, did he change the culture politically and in other ways.
Jim, you were particularly intrigued by Bob's description, his digging into the early life of Ronald Reagan. Oh,
right. I mean, I did not realize the Reagan family was hanging on by a thread. From 1910 until the time that he took that train to Hollywood. And I've got to say, you know, there are plenty of Ronald Reagan biographies out there. And I think the most authoritative might be Edmund Morris's book on Reagan. Mm. But I've got to say that yours is the most Reaganesque biography of Ronald Reagan that I've read, in that it's very approachable. You know, it's one of those books that I thought, you know, I was going to write, I was going to go after this as you might in grad school, read the first chapter, last chapter, and go in the middle, just kind of hopscotch.
Right.
No, once I started, I had to keep going.
I'm glad to hear that.
And this is what we don't know about Reagan. We don't know. He had a very, very challenging home life. He had an alcoholic father. Balanced off by a very religious mother.
Yeah, what did you make of his early life, Bob?
You know, humble is the only word that I could use to describe it. This is a guy who not only had an alcoholic father and a very pious mom, but he couldn't see. I mean, they thought maybe he was suffering from blindness. All he needed were glasses, but his parents weren't close enough to being parents, they were too self-possessed to notice that their son couldn't put two things together because he couldn't see 2 feet in front of himself. But aside from that, his mom and dad had a very difficult time putting food on the table. They often had to move under cover of night when rent came due because his father couldn't hold a job. And he grew up often sharing a single bed with his older brother, Neil. So he had a very challenging boyhood.
He was, I was intrigued by the fact that he basically had realized that college was not going to be for him. The family didn't have the money. He didn't have the money to go to college. But he was going to take his then. Are you having trouble hearing?
Yeah, I'm okay now, I think.
Okay. He was going to take his girlfriend to college. Tell the story about what happened.
Yeah, well, of course, his family didn't have the money to send him, and his father said there's nothing that I could do about it. So he packed up her car. He took her to Eureka College, which was just
in Illinois,
about 20 miles down the road from his house. And when he got out of the car, he saw the school, and he knew he had to be there some way. So he immediately went and pled his case to one of the deans of the college, and they created a scholarship right there on the spot for him. Reagan could talk anybody into anything in those days, and he was such a charming, likable guy that they thought he should be there. And he really worked like a dog for 4 years to not only pay his tuition, but also when he found that he had just a few bucks extra, he decided that he'd pay his older brother's tuition and get him to go to college as well. And so he contributed to that. Plus, he was tithing 10% of all the money he made to the church. So this was a guy, and here is where I really found things to admire this guy about. He had worked incredibly hard to pull himself up and to make a better life for himself.
It was. I thought it was very interesting that his relationship with his older brother, with Neil, his nickname was Moon.
Moon. Yes.
Right.
He was Dutch, and his brother was Moon.
And somewhere in that college period, the younger brother became the older brother.
Yes.
In a way, and that was how it stayed.
For the rest of his life.
For the rest of their lives.
Yeah, exactly right.
Which I find a very, very interesting dynamic.
All right. Because we're the political show, Bob, we are going to take on, for the most part, we're going to talk about Reagan's political life.
Right.
But it would be wrong not to touch on some of the milestones throughout the career that led him first to become governor of California and then, of course, president of the United States. We know it's a relatively famous story that he became a sports announcer, sports announcer, and was quite good at it. I think you tell an often told but always worthwhile story about his, was it a football game he was announcing or a baseball game?
Yeah, the Cubs game.
It was the Cubs, that's right. And he would get the action of the game off a ticker. He wasn't in Wrigley Field, obviously.
He was their Chicago Cubs and Chicago White Sox announcer, and he never saw a game. Yeah. He had never been to a professional game. Yeah, it all came over a teletype, and he would examine the little hieroglyphics on it and create the entire game and give it all the excitement.
And what happened one day when the ticker suddenly came to a dead halt?
Well, he had to make up something on the spot so that people wouldn't know that he was faking it all these years. So the guy continued to hit foul balls for almost 20 minutes. Reagan found out only later that the guy had fouled out on the first pitch. But for 20 minutes, he continued to,
do this. There's a theme here. Uh-huh. This is his first experience in journalism was an experience in fake news.
There you go. There you go. You have it, Jim. That's right.
All right. By the way, we just got a Facebook Live post from Eric Lawner, and he says something that I'd like to address very quickly.
Sure.
He says, "Ugh, definitely no fan of Reagan. He was a total disaster to the Republican Party and other things, and to my LGBT community. And certainly it's true that he was no friend of the LGBT community."
That's right. Mm-hmm.
The examination of his life, we're doing this. We're not making any judgments about whether I'm not talking about Reagan because he was a great president. I'm talking about him, and I think we all are, because he was a fascinating human being who certainly had an impact on politics on American life for good and ill.
And had a great story to tell, too. I mean, look, I feel the same way as your listener. As I said, I didn't vote for Ronald Reagan, but the story was incredible, and I really felt that it was kind of like the way David McCulloch would write about Truman. Mm-hmm. It's a page-turner, and you can't put it down, and we learned a little bit about ourselves by reading about this.
All right, so Reagan ends up going out to Hollywood because he's kind of at a dead end in his life in southern
yes
Illinois.
Yes and no. Let me just correct that
all
a
right.
little. This one thing that we forget about Reagan's broadcasting experience is that he was the voice of the Midwest. I mean, people for 8 states every night listened to Dutch Reagan, and they knew his voice. He was a media star wherever he went in Illinois and
Iowa.
He
was rated above Red Barber at one point.
He was. Yeah, incredible. And so it was only a dead end because it was a dead end for him.
For him.
He expected more of himself.
Right. He didn't. That's right. Okay, so he ends up on a sports trip to L.A.
Yes.
Right?
He was going to spring training. The Cubs were playing in Catalina. Thank you. A senior moment there for me. And Reagan, he goes there, but he knows that he's going to make a detour to Hollywood because he's going to give it a shot. He's going to see if he can do a screen test. And who knows? He didn't expect much of it, but he decided to give it a try.
So, and we know then, of course, that it's what happened. He ends up moving to L.A., wants to be an actor in pictures. His career, this is another thing that I think you really illuminate for us, is how unsuccessful he was early on. He was a B actor.
Yeah.
There were two parts that really put him on the map, at least a little bit. Mm-hmm. The biggest one, I think you'd have to say, is the picture King's Row. Let's play the famous moment and then tell us what that was all about. Listen.
Randy! 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 Where's the rest of me? Randy!
Yes, Drake?
It was that accident.
Yes, dear. But don't talk about it yet.
That was the line.
Where's the resume?
He was playing a part in which he lost his legs. Yep.
Well, actually, you know, he didn't have to lose his legs, but he was dating this woman, and the father, who was a doctor, wasn't very happy with that. And so when he has an accident and has to have an operation, the doctor decides to remove his legs while he's under anesthesia, and he wakes up and wants to know where the rest of them is. It was the highlight of his career.
Well, that's exactly right. And, of course, that line lives to this day as one of the most famous lines in the movies of that era.
And a lot of his opponents have always been asking, you know, where's the rest of you? Exactly.
The other picture, interestingly enough, was the Newt Rockne story.
Yes.
He wanted Rockne at first. But then he looked at the part of the Gipper.
And the producer didn't want him. I mean, because they wanted a real star, and they weren't getting a big star. So Reagan suited up in his old college uniform and went in and threw a few bullet passes to the producer, and that's how he got that job, you know, over the producer's objections.
Making Leslie Nielsen's career forever.
Yes, exactly right. That's
win
true.
One for the Gipper. He played the part of the young Notre Dame kid who dies early in his life.
Who was a real scoundrel, by the way, in real life. I mean, he was a gambler, a smoker, a drinker, gambled against games that he played in. But they kind of rewrote that.
All right. We're going to move on. Our guest is Bob Spitz. We got to get to a break. His new book is a biography of Ronald Reagan. We're going to get to the political career of Ronald Reagan in just a minute. But let's pause for just a brief moment and then come right back.
If you are the dealer, I'm out of the game.
When Leonard Cohen died in 2016, he left behind many unpublished poems and lyrics, some of which have been collected in a new book. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with his son, Adam Cohen, who wrote the introduction. Adam also produced You Want It Darker, the album his father recorded shortly before his death. Join us.
Fresh Air is this afternoon at 3 here on GPB.
From Morning Edition and On Second Thought to Political Rewind and All Things Considered, listener support makes everything you hear on GPB possible. If we didn't hear from you during our fall fund drive, your contribution now will still make a difference. Please take just a couple of minutes to support the programs you rely on and enjoy on GPB, and do your part now at whatever level is right for you. Go to gpb.org and click donate, and thanks so much for your support of Georgia Public Broadcasting.
General Electric. Here is Ronald Reagan.
Good evening. Tonight, John Forsythe stars on the General Electric Theater. And you will see product reports that show how in the things that lead to a better life for us all, at General Electric, progress is our most important product.
There's another highlight from the entertainment career of Ronald Reagan. We're talking about Reagan's life with Bob Spitz, who is the author of a brand new biography, Ronald Reagan, An American Journey. Jim Galloway is with me. It's Monday. So his career in Hollywood kind of stalled out. He ends up in TV.
Hit the skids, right. He didn't want to be a TV guy because it was so new. He didn't believe anything was going to come of it. He didn't want to die in TV. But GE was the only game in town. They offered him a slot to be the host of their weekly anthology, and he took it.
Yeah, and that's one of the great coincidences of American politics, I think.
Yes.
He went into this medium, mastered it, and then he hit his political stride just as that same medium was taking over American politics.
Yes, and not only that, this is where Reagan, being the spokesperson for GE, really finds his political voice. It happens right here, because part of the job was that they asked him not only to be their host, but during the week when he wasn't on camera, to be their ambassador. And that entailed his going to almost all the GE plants in the United States. And there were many with tens of thousands of people working in them to just talk to people and hear what was on their mind, to talk about politics, to talk about government. And he gets a sense of the working person and what is missing in their life and how the government is affecting them.
I know you did a lot of detailed research here.
Yeah.
Did you chart out where those GE factories were geographically at
all? Yeah, I mean, the biggest ones were on the East Coast, but, you know, across the country, there were many major plants, and he hit them all.
You know, Jim, here's where we see one of the real parallels between Reagan and Trump. I mean, first of all, of course, they both came out of the entertainment industry. But it was during his time at General Electric, Bob Spitz tells us, that Reagan started to get a feel for the working man and woman in this country, the blue collar, the real working people of the country. And he started to get a sense of what they needed, what they wanted.
And he started to get a sense of his own politics. He had always been a liberal Democrat. I mean, he was one of the standard bearers for FDR's policies since he was a little boy. His father was an FDR guy, and Reagan really believed in the whole package. It wasn't until he got out there and talked to the people at GE that we see the shift starting to go right. And it really goes to the right. And it moved right into conservative politics out of the GE job.
Yeah, he ended up campaigning for Richard Nixon in 60.
Right.
And then
Barry Goldwater.
Right.
And
he was still identifying as a Democrat, too, which made it very more.
I think they wanted him to stay a Democrat.
Yes. They did. Nixon sent a note that said, listen, this guy is talking Republican politics, but we need him as a Democrat for our cause.
So it was also during that time, right around General Electric Theater, maybe a little before, you'll tell me the exact frame of reference, that he became a union leader.
Yeah, it was much earlier. It was in Hollywood.
It was, okay.
He becomes president of the Screen Actors Guild. And this was, you know, every writer does a lot of research and gets to talk to a lot of people. But I was corresponding with someone who actually served on that guild with him. And the person was in Paris. And I said, I'm coming to Paris with my wife. Would you mind talking to me about Reagan's early days putting the Screen Actors Guild together? And so I got to spend 3 hours having champagne with Olivia de Havilland. She was just about to be 100 years old. And I have to tell you, she remembered everything. Her mind was sharp. She looked great. And she was Reagan's sidekick in Democratic politics and in establishing the Screen Actors Guild as a major union force.
So you know what I thought about Galloway when I thought about that particular period of his life and the turn it took and the people who he felt he could appeal to as he got into politics. Here he is. He's the head of a union, typically Democratic, you know, liberal-leaning institutions. But he goes on. He's out there at General Electric Theater. He's getting to know real working men and women. And he makes his turn to the right. And as he starts running, he begins to attract, as did Trump, the kind of working people like he was, who who typically support Democrats.
Hard-hat Democrats.
But he understands how to get to them. And that's a big parallel with him and Trump, I think.
Yes, exactly right. And the irony is, the first thing he does as president of the United States is to break a union strike.
We're going to talk about the Petco union in a few minutes.
But I will tell you, I know we're in the next few minutes, we're going to be talking about parallels between Ronald Reagan and Donald Trump and where they differ.
Go ahead.
I think this is where Ronald's the Screen Actors Guild is where Ronald Reagan's anti-Soviet attitudes are really honed.
You bet.
And it's what carries him through his political career. And I just find that so ironic with the current state of affairs at the Trump White House right now.
Yeah. Reagan really detested the Soviet Union. I mean, he famously called it the evil empire. He was a saber rattler. They called him Ronnie Reagan because of it. But the irony is he was the man who made peace with Mikhail Gorbachev at the end of his presidency.
Yeah, but so, he was the guy, too, who told his union members during the witch hunt, the communist witch hunt, to use a phrase we're hearing a lot of today, who said, go ahead and talk.
He did. He named names, too.
And he really named names, which is something that here again is where this guy had a Teflon-like career.
Right.
There are people to this day whose reputations have been shattered because they named names during those anti-communist days in Hollywood, and Reagan came out of it unscathed for the most part.
You know, one of the things that I always questioned through the book was his political conscience. I wasn't sure, and I'm sure this eluded Ed Morris, too, when he wrote Dutch. I really wasn't sure where Reagan's, you know, conscience lay in all of this. He always thought he was doing the right thing, but he had to have known better.
All right. So, again, I want to, because of our limited time, I want to skip well forward. I want to get to the days of his presidency.
Yep.
Galloway, we know he went on and he served as governor of California, sort of explored running for president really early in his run as governor.
Do you know that two weeks after he became governor, a number of his staff come into his office and said, listen, here's our playbook. And he said, for what? And he said, for the presidency. This was our goal from the beginning. He told them to cool it, but I think he always had an eye on that playbook.
So, which, Jim, I thought about Hamilton Jordan walking into Governor Jimmy Carter's office and saying, I know, Governor, you're just getting the feel for this job, but here's my plan for how you can become president of the United States.
Right. And that's exactly what didn't happen with Donald Trump.
Right.
He didn't have an underlying staff to kind of pave the way and help him forward.
Mm. One of the great things about Reagan, one of the things that I really admired was that he put a fabulous staff together between the time that he was nominated, that he won the presidency, and that he took office, because they wanted to hit the ground running from day one. And within a month, they had filled all the posts that they needed to fill. They had filled, you know, judgeships. You look at what's happening today, and
still half of the positions.
More than half, yeah, exactly right.
So Reagan finally runs for president, bites the bullet in 1976, and mounts a campaign against Gerald Ford, who, of course, had become president because of Watergate. It doesn't go. He loses to Ford.
Yeah, I mean, he runs against an incumbent, which was unheard of. And so it really split the Republican Party.
Right, and he mortally wounds Gerald Ford.
Oh, he does. Yeah. I mean, that was why Ford did not win.
So here's why that's interesting, among other things. You just said it. He splits the Republican Party.
Yes.
Here's Reagan, the conservative, running against Ford, a moderate Republican, a more sensible, you would say, Republican, and Reagan begins a cleft that we see to this very day.
Oh, it began right there.
Yeah.
No doubt about it.
Yeah.
No doubt about it.
So let's move to another presidential campaign. It's 1979. Georgia's Jimmy Carter is in the White House. Things are not going particularly well for President Carter in so many ways. But he clearly wants another term in office. And I want to take us to that incredible moment that was another one of the touchstones in his entire career. Reagan was running against four other Republicans. There's Bob Dole, George H.W. Bush, John Anderson.
Phil Crane. Howard Baker. And John Connolly.
Okay, there are that many.
Right? It's the Seven Dwarfs, is it not?
Oh, that's right, of course. Well, right. I'm going to set this up, and then you'll tell us what happened.
Yeah.
The Reagan people think that the real fight, despite all of these other candidates, is going to come down to him and George H.W. Bush.
Right, because Bush had the momentum.
Yeah, Bush had the big mo the first time around. And so they propose that there should be a one-on-one debate because they figured they can take George H.W. in a debate. And they begin to move the ball forward on that process. There's, I think, a newspaper or a radio station that agrees to sponsor it.
Yes, a newspaper was sponsoring it. Right,
okay.
Exactly right.
But when it all came down to it, the only way that debate could proceed was if Reagan's campaign paid for the time to put this debate on the air.
Right. Bush didn't want to do it because he said, why do I need to debate you? And they set him up. They said, look, you know, it'll be a debate between the two front runners, and we'll knock all those other guys out of there, and then we'll really get down to business, and you're beating us anyway.
Yeah.
So they convinced Bush to do this, but Bush said, I can't pay for it, and the paper's not going to pay for it. And Reagan's campaign said, don't worry about a thing. We will pay for the whole debate, and that's what it all turned on.
Except that the night of the debate, all the other Republicans, the Reagan people decided at the last minute they've got to let everybody else in the debate.
Oh, they didn't decide. They
well, they were forced.
All right, fine. Yeah.
So here we are. George Bush and Ronald Reagan are seated in their formal debate positions, and standing in the background are all the other Republican candidates. And
Bush is steaming.
Bush is furious because he's lost control of the entire situation.
And he's lost his whole sense of being at that time.
And at that moment, the moderator of the debate tries to shut Ronald Reagan up. Let's listen to what happened.
Would the sound man please turn Mr. Reagan's mic off for a minute? Is this on? Mr. Green,
did you turn on the microphone?
You asked for me if you would. I am paying for this microphone, Mr. Green.
Again, another one of those famous moments in his career.
His campaign manager, John Sears, told me he turned to somebody at that moment and he said, we just won the election.
Yeah, and poor George H.W. Galloway is sitting there realizing.
He knew what happened too.
You know, when it came time to pick the vice presidential candidate, Reagan didn't want to pick Bush because of that night. He said, I don't want a man second to me who has no nerve, who lost his nerve. He could only focus on that night with George Bush.
Yeah. It was a remarkable moment. And let's talk about this is not unusual for the behavior of Ronald Reagan. One of the reasons that he was either beloved or despised was his willingness to be incredibly forceful, to push his will and to exert his will. And that theme plays out through his entire presidency.
Absolutely right. The one thing, you know, I will tell you that Reagan was not always the smartest man in the room, and he knew it. He didn't understand the big complex issues, but he had a gut instinct, and when he believed in something, he was behind it 100%. He wasn't going to let anything stand in the way. And so later on, of course, we get Star Wars, mm-hmm. and we get Reaganomics.
And we get the index cards year after year after year, which don't change.
And when someone goes off script, he's not able to really follow that script and to go off script and to comprehend something. So,
but as long as we're comparing Reagan to Trump, I think the one thing that strikes me out of your book, Bob, is that Reagan understood the power of charisma and the power of the personal touch, mm-hmm. but he also understood he knew what he didn't know.
He did, absolutely. You know, people always say to me, well, Reagan wasn't a deep thinker, but his thinking was deeply felt. That's the difference. And people intuited that right away and understood it. And I think that's really what made him so forceful.
You know, you said a minute ago that, you know, Reagan didn't know a lot. He wasn't the best informed guy on issues.
Well, this is a guy who got C's, D's,
right,
and F's in college.
So one of the quotes in your book that really jumped out at me, and I don't know where you found this, was Al Haig, who worked for him as his first Secretary of State. Now, I covered Al Haig's brief presidential campaign, and I know what a difficult character he could be. But you quote him as saying, Reagan's not a mean man, just stupid.
Yeah.
This, too, echoes what this is Bob Woodward writing about the Trump White House.
Yeah, well, the difference is the word mean, you say. Reagan was not a mean man. He didn't have a hostile bone in his body. And also the difference, too, is that Reagan was a uniter. You know, I mean, that was his whole goal. That, if you want to draw a comparison to the man today, there it is.
Well, then, before we take a break, you call him a uniter.
Yeah.
Let's listen to a moment in which he really had to bring the country together.
The crew of the Space Shuttle Challenger honored us for the manner in which they lived their lives. We will never forget them, nor the last time we saw them this morning, as they prepared for their journey and waved goodbye and slipped the surly bonds of Earth to touch the face of God.
The President of the United States addressing the country in the aftermath of the Challenger explosion. But you set this up for us. There was another event that was supposed to take center stage that day. It was the day of his State of the Union address.
Oh, it was his State of the Union address.
Yeah.
Exactly right. And it wasn't going to be well thought of.
Yeah, he was having a rough time.
He was. In fact,
Reaganomics was a disaster.
A disaster, exactly right. That people weren't buying the Strategic Defense Initiative. And his popularity, believe it or not, was at 35%. Yeah. The day after he gives that speech about the Challenger, his popularity hit 70%.
This is the key difference between Ronald Reagan and Donald Trump.
Absolutely.
Ronald Reagan understood the power of a good script, and he knew what a good script was.
Yes,
and he
did.
He had good script writers.
Yeah. He was also a great performer.
He was a great performer. And I have to tell you, Jim, that a lot of those speeches that he gave, he wrote himself, believe it or not. He wrote them out longhand. He had people polish them afterwards. But he was a pretty good writer on his own merits.
All right. We got to get to another break. Mm. So let's do that. We've got so much more to talk about. One of the things, Bob, is your book, you have a gripping account of the day early in his tenure, 2 months in, that he was almost murdered in an assassination attempt. We'll talk about that and a lot more when we come back with Bob Spitz, author of Reagan, An American Journey.
This fall, we're counting on the participation of everyone who listens to cover the rising costs of the programs we bring you on GPB. If we didn't hear from you during our fall fund drive, there's still time to support the programs that make a difference in your life. Please take a moment now to make an online contribution. Go to gpb.org and click donate at the top of the page. Your contribution at whatever level is right for you will help cover the costs of the programs you love on GPB. Thank you so much for your support of Georgia Public Broadcasting.
Bob Spitz and Jim Galloway with me in the studio today. Bob, March 30th, 1981. That's literally 2 months to the day. He was inaugurated on January 20th, 1981. 2 months later, he's giving a speech at a hotel in downtown Washington. What happens?
He's coming out of the speech. It's a speech he didn't want to give. It was to union people, as a matter of fact, people who weren't going to vote for him. And so he went as a matter of courtesy, because he said he would. And as he's walking out, a young man appears from the crowd and fires several shots.
Let's listen to how CNN broke into its news programming to give this special report.
There's been a late development. Shots reported fired outside the hotel where President Reagan spoke a short while ago. Here's Bernard Shaw in our Washington bureau.
Details are very sketchy at this moment. We don't know precisely what happened. We don't know the sequence. First of all, the president is safe. We are told that shots were fired at his party as he left the hotel. The District of Columbia Metropolitan Police report that at least one police officer and one Secret Service agent have been injured. They were shot down. Their condition, we do not know.
The president was not safe. It's understandable in the scramble to get this story out immediately. Apparently, even the White House was putting out word that Reagan was safe.
Even his Secret Service person, when they herded him into a car, thought that, you know, he just had the wind knocked out of him.
Yeah, he was thrown into the car. The agent, you describe it vividly.
Yeah, throws himself right on top of Reagan. And Reagan says, "Jerry, get off me. I feel like you're breaking my ribs. I can't breathe."
Yeah. He's taken to George Washington Hospital.
Yeah.
Where he is closer to death than many people realize to this day.
Oh, it was touch and go. I mean, the odd thing was he had just bought this gorgeous new suit. And as he's laying on the gurney, they realize he's been hit, and they're cutting the suit off of him. And Reagan can, you know, he's lapsing in and out of consciousness, but he comes to at one point and he says, hey, hold on, you're ruining my suit. I mean, you know, it was almost comical, but it was touch and go. And there was a very good chance that at one point that he would not make it.
You know, Galloway, you know how we always replay in our mind certain things that people say to us, and later we say, "Oh, if I'd only said this." Well, the doctor who operated on Reagan had a moment in which he got it right. Reagan says to him as they're going into surgery, "I hope you're a Republican." And the doctor says,
"We're all Republicans today."
That's right. And that doctor was a lefty liberal from the get-go.
They couldn't find the wound at first.
No. The bullet, when it
was
hit,
it was just a tiny 22, was it not?
It was a 22, but he had filed the bullet. But also, when it went through, a groove in the car, and it flattened, so it was the shape of a dime when it entered Reagan. They could barely see the slit that went through his body, and so they had a very hard time finding that bullet and removing it too.
His number shot back up again in the aftermath of that, Jim.
Yeah, you hate to think that that's necessary.
Right. Reagan, I think he said jokingly, he said, you know, if I could only get shot every day the way my numbers are going.
Yeah, the problem he had was, of course, number one, his economic plan never accomplished what he believed it would. You know, but he hated George H.W. Bush, among other things, for talking about voodoo economics during the campaign, and never quite got over George H.W. saying that. But Reaganomics became as negative a label as voodoo economics had been.
That's true. And but even today, the Reagan people insist that economic program saved our country.
Yeah.
I mean, this is one thing that they're wrong on.
Yeah, if I could take you back to the assassination attempt. James Brady, of course, was gunned down. He was the press secretary for Reagan. He was never the same after that.
No.
But an anti-gun violence organization sprung up around him. Where was Ronald Reagan on gun control and the Second Amendment?
Yeah. Well, Reagan was in favor of gun ownership. He had owned a gun when he was a kid.
Sure.
He had one that he carried with him all the time when he was an announcer.
Yeah, he stopped an assault in Iowa.
He did. But one of the things that separated him from the Republicans again was when the Brady Bill came along, Reagan endorsed it and wrote an op-ed piece that appeared across the country. And he took a lot of steam for that, but he decided that this was an act of violence that he couldn't get behind, and he was going to support that bill.
He was, by the time the reelection campaign came along in 84, there were enough negatives on his plate that a strong, strong challenge from a Democrat, I don't know whether you would have beaten Reagan, but it could have been a closer contest.
It would have been a horse race.
It turned out to be.
Yeah.
And let's be clear. I mean, the economic policies were not working. Our deficit was growing by leaps and bounds. In much the same way people now talk about how the tax cuts that the Republicans under Trump pushed through are growing the deficit like crazy.
Right.
He was never, and I think it's always important to point out the fact that while he was a leader who people admired in many ways, he wasn't for LGBT rights. He ignored the AIDS epidemic completely, which the gay community still holds him responsible for.
Oh, he was tone deaf completely,
His record on working with the African-American community was bad. He treated welfare recipients he talked about essentially. He told apocryphal stories that he'd heard in the ether.
This is where the index card comes in the welfare queen.
The welfare queen, exactly right.
So
he knew that story wasn't true, and he continued to tell it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, but instead, the Democrats bring in Walter Mondale, who just really never quite was able to catch fire for whatever reasons. But I just want to play that one moment again. We're kind of going through some of the great moments of his life. He's in a debate with Mondale.
And not doing well, by the way.
It was his first debate, and after, was it first or
no,
second?
No, it was the second one.
Okay, and the second one. Thank you, because the first debate
the first
had been
one
a
was
disaster.
A disaster, yeah.
So the second one comes along, and the moderator, one of the questioners, who's a reporter from the Baltimore Sun, has this question for him, and we get this famous Reagan answer.
I recall yet that President Kennedy had to go for days on end with very little sleep during the Cuba Missile Crisis. Is there any doubt in your mind that you would be able to function in such circumstances?
Not at all, Mr. Truitt, and I want you to know that also I will not make age an issue of this campaign. I am not going to exploit for political purposes my opponent's youth and inexperience.
Yeah, right. Yeah. He had that in his pocket for almost a week. He had been trying that quote out on a few of his colleagues, and they said, whenever you can get that in. And that changed the whole tenor of the debate. I mean, that was it. Mondale famously said afterwards, I knew right then and there that I had lost the election.
Just flipped a negative and turned it into a positive.
Yeah,
right
exactly
away.
Right.
One thing, I know we're running,
fine.
We're close on time. Nancy Reagan.
Yes.
Okay. We've got turmoil in our current White House, but we forget the power center that Nancy Reagan was back in that day. And you write very well about her.
Yeah. You know, it's funny when I began to write about Nancy, I had the same image that we all had of her as this ice queen, aloof. But it was like deja vu all over again. When I wrote about the Beatles, Yoko Ono, everyone said, was the villain of the story. And in fact, Yoko was not the villain of that story. Yoko probably saved John's life during that period of time. Yes, she had very bad PR, and the other Beatles didn't like her. It was the same with Nancy Reagan. She plays the Yoko Ono part. But Nancy Reagan had one thing that nobody realized, and that is her sights were set on only one thing, and that was making sure of her husband's legacy. She wanted him to go down in history as a man of peace. And that is the one thing that she had on her agenda the entire time he was in office. And she urged him, if you do nothing else, make peace with the premier of the Soviet Union.
And he worked tirelessly at that. He had a pretty willing partner in Mikhail Gorbachev.
Yeah, but he walked away from it. Reagan walks away from it.
Right.
Yeah, he didn't have what it took to admit that SDI was a complete
strategic
fantasy.
Defense initiative. This notion that you could create a dome of defense, essentially, against incoming missiles.
And of course, the Soviet Union didn't know if that worked or not. We knew it didn't work, but they didn't know if it worked or not, and they didn't want to take any chance. And what they wanted was his assurance that there would not be a war in space that the United States would initiate and have defenses against. And Reagan said, don't worry, we'll give you, if this works, we'll give you all of our secrets, and you can have a space bubble, too. But they didn't trust him.
So we are down to the last couple minutes of our time. And I Bob, I read your book, and, you know, I was a young political guy interested in politics in the early years of Reagan, and then ended up covering politics by the time of his reelection campaign. And I never quite knew what to make of the guy. There were many things in which his conservative politics at times were so difficult in terms of the groups that he left out that he didn't care about. But when I read your book, I saw a guy, in contrast to President Trump, he's a guy who did, at least the way he spoke, tried to appeal to our better angels. Now, that doesn't have anything to do with policy, because we're still paying for some of the policies that he put in place in a negative way.
Right.
But how did you come away thinking about this guy as a lifelong Democrat?
Yeah, well, here's what here's what pulled me through it. And this is, it made me realize that the one thing Reagan did was he always had a great belief in America and the American people.
That was sincere.
Yes, it was. All the American people, not just some of the American people. And in that last speech that he gives in the White House, he talks about that shining city on the hill. And he said, if the city has to have walls, if the city has to have walls, then all the walls should have doors, and that anyone who wants to live in peace and harmony should be allowed to live here.
But that's why it's complicated, because, Galloway, that's a beautiful thing to say, and yet the policies of the Reagan White House did not always act in that manner.
And in that phrase is the root of the anti-immigration sentiment that is roiling the Republican Party right now.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. But Reagan, you know, Reagan wasn't, he believed it. He believed in all that sentimental stuff. And you know, it was Hollywood. It was riding into the sunset with the white hat. This is the way he always saw things.
I think that in his inaugural speech, you point out, isn't it the inaugural speech? You point out that he's taken lines from a Hollywood, or he's remembering lines from a Hollywood movie?
Absolutely. He does it several times in his career.
Right. All right. We are completely out of time. I'm getting the high sign from Tom Faust. Bob Spitz, your book is, excuse me, Reagan, An American Journey. It's really been a pleasure. You're at the Atlanta History Center tonight.
Yes.
At, I think, 8 o'clock. I haven't had a chance to look to see whether you're sold out or not, but I know you have a lot more stories you would like you'll be able to share tonight.
I do, yeah.
All right, so if people who are listening in the Atlanta area get to the History Center tonight, Bob Spitz will be there. Galloway, you got a very quick last word?
Or if you're doing some early shopping for the holidays, let me say on behalf of Mr. Spitz, think about it.
Oh,
wow,
my
that's
gosh.
Lovely. Thank you.
Wow. Bob Spitz, we really had fun having you here today.
Me too. My pleasure. Thanks.
We'll be back again, of course, tomorrow at 2. We're going to get back to talking about this extraordinary governor's race that's going on in Georgia right now. We'll be back on Wednesday at 2. Remember, Friday at 2, we will be talking to Democratic gubernatorial candidate Stacey Abrams live in our studio. That really should be interesting. I'm Bill Nygut. I'll see you all again tomorrow at 2.